Testing, 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 testing.
We'll call the Planning Commission meeting for the 27th of February 2019 to order. We have a roll call and determination of a quorum, please.
Chairperson Sattler. Commissioner Borders.
Here.
Commissioner Dowers.
Present.
Commissioner Eswine.
Here.
Commissioner Preston.
Here.
Commissioner Tingle.
Here.
Commissioner Higgins.
Wiggins.
Quorum is present.
Thank you. Commissioner Wiggins, would you lead us in the pledge, please?
Sure.
Public comment. The public is invited at this time to comment on and discuss any topic that is relevant to or within the authority of the Planning Commission, including any matters that is not specifically included on the agenda as an action item. Is there any public comment at this time? Seeing none, for possible action, approval of the minutes from January 15th, 2019. Any changes or comments or it's not a motion.
I move to approve the minutes.
We have a motion from Commissioner Tingle, a second.
I second that.
Second from Commissioner Doors, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, abstain.
Oh.
Mr. Borders.
Abstains?
Yes.
And I as well. Abstain.
Okay. Commissioner Wiggins abstains. Thank you.
Who's there?
The agenda?
No modification. I just want to really note at this point, we're going to take things in order in the agenda, but we have new technology in the room since your last meeting. Obviously, you've figured out the microphone so far, push the button, you get a green light, talk, push the button again to turn it off, but also for the public's sake, when you come to the podium and talk, there's a button push. When you get the green light, then the microphone's on.
Meeting items. E1 for discussion only. A presentation by District Attorney Jason Lidberry and Chief Assistant District Anthony Dan Yu regarding the upcoming Carson City Municipal Code update, including an update of Title 18 zoning and the associated development standards. Hope.
I'll turn it over to our district attorney, Jason Woodbury, and his deputy, Dan Yu. They'll be making a presentation.
Welcome, gentlemen. Thanks for coming.
That won't be the last thing I screw up tonight.
I get that all the time.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and thank you to the Commission for allowing us some time tonight to talk about what we view as a very important project that's going to be going forward through my office for on behalf of Carson City, and it's a project that certainly community development staff is going to be a very important part of, and we hope that this commission is willing to be a very important part of that too. And that is basically we are undertaking what I knew would be a massive project and what is turning out to, as we get into it, be even bigger than I had realized. And what it is a comprehensive revision of the Carson City Municipal Code. The Carson City Municipal Code is a collection of all of the ordinances that apply in Carson City that have been adopted over the course of Carson City and before that, Ormsby County's existence. It's voluminous, and that the issues that we have encountered, as this commission is certainly acutely aware of, is from time to time you encounter a provision that is in conflict or apparent conflict with another provision. From time to time you encounter a provision that is not necessarily clear in terms of how you are to apply it. And that is not just with the code that you deal with, it's throughout the code. The Carson City Municipal Code is functional. It's worked for many, many years, and in almost all instances it works just fine. But it is those instances where it doesn't work fine that we're trying to fix and to fix in a way that is valuable for years to come. So that's what we're hoping to talk to you tonight about, is sort of how we look at that project. It's definitely a 30,000 foot view that we're trying to give you. There's much more detail if you're at all interested in it, and I invite you to chat with me or with Dan or with Mr. Johnson there if you want some more detail about it. But we just want to give you an idea of what we're going to be doing and how we'd like you to be involved with that as well. So this presentation is for your benefit. Please do not hesitate to interrupt me with questions, and because we want to we want you to be it to be beneficial to you. So where we start is at the bottom is, what do we want the code to be? What does it mean to be a good law? How does that help the community? What attributes do we need to have for that? And we gave a similar presentation to the Board of Supervisors at their workshop, and these are what they came up with. They wanted to be, and I've kind of grouped them together in the things that are similar. They want it to be clear. They want it to be readable, and in particular, the mayor mentioned that he doesn't want people to have to hire a lawyer to get through the code. He wants people to be able to pick it up and understand it, and that's certainly something we hope to achieve. They want it to be comprehensive, integrated, consistent, cross-referenced within itself, and cross-referenced to the Nevada laws that apply. They don't want it to be redundant. They want it to be reasonable, relevant, realistic, enforceable, and they want the benefits to outweigh the costs. And so we certainly invite your input tonight or continuing if you think there are additional objectives that we should keep in mind as we go through this process trying to revise the code. So one thing we want to help everyone understand is that drafting legislation is not nearly as easy as it might seem on its face. And we don't want to come off like we're complaining about our job or whining that people just don't understand how hard it is. We think you making the recommendations to the Board of Supervisors will make better recommendations if you understand why it's hard and what makes it hard, and why lawyers, for all the lawyer jokes, sort of why it's hard because of lawyers. And you'd go to law school and you're sort of trained. I always thought it was amusing that they train you to think like a lawyer. That's what you're always told. And that really didn't resonate with me. But as time has gone on, thinking like a lawyer really means you take clarity, something that seems very clear, and you manipulate that for your client's interests. You try to manipulate that meaning. Drafting legislation is sort of the opposite of that. You try to make clarity. And so in a way, it's going to be Mr. You and myself against the world of lawyers trying to make something as clear as we possibly can, even in the face of somebody who might be trying to manipulate that for their client's interest. So you take a provision like this, and this is just a kind of a silly example, but what if you had a code provision that said something like, no building in Carson City may be higher than the Capitol? Now, to a normal human being, that looks like something that's pretty clear on its face. You can't have a building in Carson City that's higher than the Capitol, but a lawyer can come along, and if the client's interest is served and the price is right, you can manipulate that. So what if I want to build a cell tower, and I want the cell tower to be higher than the Capitol? Well, I'd say the cell tower is not a building, so this code provision clearly doesn't apply to that. You can just sort of see how something that seems clear, there might be a number of circumstances where you find something to fight about, something to argue about, something to make not clear. And what we have traditionally done in the past, and what is actually a rule of statutory construction, is that when there is a lack of clarity, you go back to the legislative intent, right? The quote-unquote legislative intent, and we've all heard that. And that can be dangerous. And first of all, if we draft a code and you recommend a code and the board approves a code that requires us to go back and look at legislative intent, we failed. Because a clear code, a clear provision, you should never have to do that. It should be clear on its face, and you never have to get to that. And the danger is this. So let's say we've got that code provision that says no building in Carson City is going to be higher than the Capitol. So we go back, and we've got recordings of all the proceedings, and we can go back and actually listen to the proceeding where that code, that provision was adopted. And they actually had that discussion. Okay, what does it mean higher than the Capitol? And this particular discussion is, are we talking about the dome of the Capitol? Are we talking about the flagpole on top of the Capitol? What are we talking about? So we've got this board who's the one that adopted that. And Supervisor Shirk at the time says the flagpole is the top. And Supervisor Abow chimes in, I agree. Supervisor Bonkowski says it's a dumb idea and he's going to vote no. Supervisor Bagwell says, I'm a no, Carson City needs a skyscraper. And then Mayor Kroll doesn't say anything, but what he's thinking is, I think the top is the dome, but we've been on this item for hours, I'm hungry and I want to go home, so I'm not starting a debate. So I'm a yes. So you've got two people on the record saying they think the top is a flagpole, and that's all that's been stated on the record by the people who voted in favor of the provision. In fact, there is not a majority of the board that believes the flagpole is the top. But that becomes the rule, because you've got poor Lee over there listening to this provision that's adopted, and the only thing he hears is the top is the flagpole. And I've got a picture of Lee. This is the newest one I could find. So that's just Lee having trouble with that. And the point of this is that you've now divorced the enforcement of that provision from the actual text of the code. The text is no building in Carson City can be higher than the Capitol, but what you're actually enforcing in reality is that no building in Carson City can be higher than the top of the flagpole on the Capitol Dome. And that's, like I said, it's kind of a silly example, but that gives you an idea of how important it's going to be as precise as we can in the language that we take to the Board of Supervisors, and certainly the language that comes out of the Board of Supervisors going to be very important, because you'll eventually be the ones, along with citizens of Carson City, who are being guided by that. So So what happens in that instance when you've got a divorce between the reality of the code and the text of the code is you get the troublemakers who start asking, why is this the rule? And sometimes it's a supervisor, sometimes it's staff, sometimes it's a member of the public. And our worst case scenario is the lawsuit, that they're saying you are not enforcing the text of the code. And the last place we want to be is defending that on the basis of, well, we've always done it that way, because that legally is not, it's meaningless. I mean, it's just not a position that we can defend in court. So that's what we're trying to get to. So more nuts and bolts of how we're going to try to get to the outcome we want. We are right now in the process of drafting a drafting manual. And when I say we, that's Dan. We are really fortunate to have Dan. Dan spent many, many years as a in the Legislative Council Bureau, where that's their profession. I mean, they draft bills and laws and regulations and do this day in and day out. So Dan has the expertise that we need to put together this kind of project. We just wouldn't be able to do it without him. So Dan is preparing a drafting manual. And this is not going to be, you know, a 10-page document. It's going to talk about the minutiae of minutiae and when you should use shall instead of must and all sorts of things like that. And certainly that's for the people drafting the manual. But it's also for you to help you understand. And you're not expected certainly to know the intricacies of that. That's our job. But if you can have a familiarity, we're going to make that available to everybody. And if you can have a familiarity with the rules that we are trying to follow, I think it might help you provide some better recommendations to the board. So Dan is going to have that completed by June 30th of this year. He's been working a long time on it and working very hard on it. But from there, where we go is a comprehensive review of the existing code. And what we're looking for in that process is the low-hanging fruit. What are the provisions that clearly conflict with one another? What are the cross-references to Nevada statute that have expired or are no longer tied to the original provision or what have you? It's just really a cleanup. So those are the things we're going to be trying to do. And that's in the second half of this year, calendar year 2019. And we're going to go from there into preparing a structural outline. Some of the organization of the code doesn't make complete sense, and some chapters should be in other titles, and some titles should probably be moved. So just getting together a structural outline of the code and how the whole thing should look. From there, we'll go to sort of what we call stage two of that, and we will be going through the code title by title and actually changing the substance of the code. Where we start is with the preliminary title. That's going to have your definitions that apply throughout the entire code. For instance, there'll be a definition in there that says the quote-unquote board with a capital B, means the Board of Supervisors. And when we say person, and we mean a corporation. And it'll have those, you know, definitions that apply throughout the code. So that's the first thing we'll be working on. And then other low-hanging fruit that we've got that doesn't necessarily concern this board or this commission is we start with criminal and traffic, Title 8 and Title 10. That's low-hanging fruit for us because the vast majority of those provisions are going to be cut and paste from the Nevada revised statutes, which will be consistent with the drafting manual that we'll have put together. So we expect to have that done in the first or second quarter of 2020. And then we get to the big one, and that's you guys. That's Title 17 and Title 18 are going to be the next thing that we take on. And our vision for how that works is that we're relying primarily, and that's a substantive kind of revision. This is not just cleaning up language. This is not just making the code consistent with throughout, although that's an important part of it. But that's a substantive look at do these provisions work for us? Or is there some other direction that we want to recommend to the board, that we want to have staff look at, and that we want to discuss about that? So we'll be certainly relying mainly on staff to do that, and I know that staff will be vetting that through you. I know it's important for the Board of Supervisors to have, in particular, this commission's input on Title 17 and 18, mainly Title 18. But that's a big one. I mean, that's the biggest, most complex, most voluminous title that we have. And our target right now, is to get through that in 9 months. And we'll adjust. It's obviously more important to do it right than to do it quickly. But we'll adjust that if we need to. But that's an aggressive target. But that's 9 months from when we start drafting. That certainly is not intended to say, okay, you guys should just all be waiting around until you get to your 9 months. We're hopeful that as we go throughout the rest of this year and the first couple quarters of 2020, that those discussions with staff happen, and that when it's time, when we're ready, that we have a package of substantive changes and substantive ideas that you're ready to give to Dan and I, that we can take and sort of put in the language of the code as we're trying to do it. We don't intend, I expect we'll be involved a little bit in the substance, legal procedures and things like that. You know, we'll have some input about that. But by and large, the substance of it and what you want the code to be and what staff wants the code to recommend to the board, that's the prerogative of this body and staff to put that substance together. We're just trying to put that into the language that has it make sense with the rest of the code and with Nevada law. So it goes on from there. It's about, we've targeted 4 years for the completion of all the titles in the code. And then from there, there's sort of a stage three where it's continuous improvement of the code. It's not going to be perfect. So we'll look for opportunities after that to continue to refine it and make it, you know, as effective for everybody as it can be. But stage two is going to be a challenging process. But we're hoping to take it on and produce a product that's really effective. I can tell you that Carson City is by no means unique in terms of its code. In fact, as far as codes go throughout the state, ours is, I would say, one of the better ones. You're talking jurisdictions like Washoe County and Clark County and things like that. It's, this problem is not unique to us. And it's, I don't mean to imply that it's anybody's fault either, that people are trying to take a piece of law and make it work. And, you know, because of their jobs or because maybe they didn't have the expertise, it made it work for that, but maybe it made it inconsistent for something else, and it just became a collection instead of what we hope it to be, you know, sort of a unified, consistent piece of legislation that we're looking for. So, I'll shut up now and let Dan, do you have anything to add?
I just like to say for the record, this sounds like a lot of work. I don't know what I signed up for, so I'm going to sign this over to Ben Johnson over here. No, we're happy to take this on. I think Jason's hit all the points. And one of the things that I kind of want to circle back on that he started with was, you know, when it comes to legislative drafting, you know, proper legislative drafting, what we're always talking about is the intent of the body that's enacting the ordinance or the statute, you know, the regulation, the resolution, whatever the case may be. And, you know, the driving force behind that is always the intent of the body. And, you know, Jason has identified, you know, quite you know, aptly here, you know, all the problems with having to go back and look at legislative history to ascertain that sort of intent. And so, of course, you know, the overriding motive and the objective to be accomplished here is to make sure that we capture the intent correctly the first time. And the way we do that is to make sure that the language that's being codified in our code of ordinances is plain, it's unambiguous on its face, so that there's never any need necessarily to go back and try to ascertain, you know, the intent of the body that enacted it, perhaps years or even decades ago. A lot of times, you know, there's a deficiency in those sort of, you know, legislative archive material, so it's difficult to accomplish that from time to time. And you know, as Jason pointed out, sometimes there's even ambiguity on the record as to, well, what was actually the intent if you can't ascertain that just from the language itself. So that's certainly one of our overarching objectives here, is to make sure that we capture at all times the legislative intent of, you know, all of our boards, our commissions, our committees, and then, of course, the Board of Supervisors as well. That is, you know, the driving force for this, you know, overall, you know, overhaul of CCMC. You know, the kind of way, the way I look at it is, it's, you know, we have this vehicle in place, and it's always, you know, it's always in motion, right? I mean, that's our CCMC provisions. It's one large locomotive. It's always in motion. And we're just trying to, and as Jason pointed out, you know, to a great extent, it works, it functions, it accomplishes what we need it to accomplish on a day-to-day basis. It's something that provides guidance and guidelines and parameters for our staff and for the attorneys at the DA's office. And you know what Jason and I want to do, and this is, you know, one of Jason's mission objectives, you know, as part of his administration, is we want to put a really nice polish on this locomotive and, you know, just kind of make sure that we, you know, clean off all the dirt and grime and make sure that it's, you know, as clear and unambiguous as possible, not only for staff and for the city employees and the DA's office and, you know, for the attorneys and everyone else that's involved in the process, but also for members of the public. John and Jane Doe should be able to read it, open up the books, and understand exactly what they're reading, what their obligations are, what the requirements are, and what their rights are as well.
Mr. Chairman, can I?
Go ahead.
Can I just to add on with some regarding Title 18, talk a little bit about in particular. So the you can see this is going to be a very long process. Obviously, it is a big job to rewrite Title 18. And as he said, we're not going to go away and wait until they're ready to do that. The direction from the Board of Supervisors is to start the discussions with the Planning Commission. And just for example, kind of one small part would be to look at what uses are permitted in what zoning districts. Can some of those uses be combined into different descriptions, and then to be able, when they're ready to hand that over, then to draft it into a new format, into the title. So we do plan in 2019 to start bringing these discussions to the Planning Commission to start working on it. Also, in having discussion with them, there are some things that are hanging out there, like accessory dwellings or other things that might come up that need to be fixed sooner rather than later, and we'll still bring those forward and those types of corrections to put into the current ordinance, with the understanding that it'll be rewritten in the bigger changes later.
I was going to ask, as these sections are done, will they be implemented, or are you going to wait till everything's done, say, in 4 years before everything is in, or what? How will that?
We'll implement them title by title. What we've tried to design this project so that each step has independent value. So The creation of the drafting manual has value. I mean, if you don't go forward with the rest of the project, it at least gives you a map of going forward. Here's what you should be doing, and there's just practical reasons for that. You know, if a recession hits and you know, staff is cut, we may not be able to move forward with this project. We may have to put it on hold. So it's very important that we wanted each step to have independent value. So they'll. Answering your question directly, these titles will be implemented as they are completed. I think it's important to implement a title as a whole, so the board is able to see the whole picture of the title as they do that. But there's no need to wait and do all the titles at once. But I do also want to echo what Lee said, that, you know, the way I've tried to explain it to people is we're sort of in break fix mode right now. So if there's a broken piece of the code, we want to fix it. I mean, there's no need to wait and say, hey, well, you got to wait, you know, a year and a half till we're on Title 18. If there's an urgency, we'll move forward with staff and get that fixed.
Well, and I see our role more being possibly, too, looking at things that come to us constantly, maybe by making some minor changes over time, they've been affected or whatever. for example, the dwelling size being added, you know, we might modify that. That would simplify where not as many have to come forward, too, to be considered. But, again, we kind of look at the general overview, give it to you folks to then put it in line as to how it has to be to work in the system. So.
I also know that the Board of Supervisors is interested in reworking the master plan. And I just want to make sure that we get all this in concert, because I would hate to have us do all this work on title revision and then we decide halfway through that we're going to change the master plan a little bit and it's going to totally change some of these titles again. So I'm hoping that we're aware that that may also happen and we've got that considered as we move forward, recognizing that the titles are the titles and the master plan is a planning document, but they've got to fit together.
Agreed, and I think that's important.
Well, and I think quite a few of the board, et cetera, feel that Title 18 cleaning that up may help a lot with what's going on in the master plan as well, so to help clarify that. Questions or comments?
Thank you for your time. Appreciate being here. Thanks.
Appreciate it. Moving on. Public hearing E2 SUP-18-166 for possible action to consider request for a special use permit for a new 70-foot tall wireless communication facility on property zone retail commercial RC. The subject property is located at 3331 South Carson Street, APN 009-112-17. Heather?
Thank you. Heather Ferris, Associate Planner for the record. Before I get into the specifics of this particular request, I do want to take a minute to touch on the relationship between the federal and local laws with regard to wireless communication facilities. The Federal Telecommunications Act regulates wireless facilities and prohibits local governments from writing ordinances that impose unreasonable barriers to the siting of towers or antennas and the provisions of wireless services. Local governments cannot discriminate among providers of functionally equivalent services, prohibit or effectively prohibit wireless service provisions, or regulate wireless facilities based on the environmental effect of radio frequency emissions, assuming facilities are in compliance with FCC regulations. Local governments do have the ability to regulate the location and design elements of towers, setbacks and screening requirements, and different standards for residential zone districts, historic districts, or environmentally sensitive areas. Carson City Municipal Code related to the siting of such facilities are based on requirements of the Telecommunications Act and generally provide guidance with regard to location, height, setbacks, and screening. With that background, I'll now get into the request that's before the Commission today. Carson City Municipal Code 18.15 requires approval of a special use permit for construction and operation of a wireless telecommunication facility in any non-residentially zoned district, unless the tower is proposed as a co-location on an existing tower and does not increase the height of the tower by more than 10 feet. The tower meets the height restrictions of the proposed zoning district, or the tower does not increase the height of an existing structure that already exceeds the height limit of that particular zoning district. The applicant is proposing the construction of a 70-foot tall monopole wireless communication facility with an 18-foot by 32-foot lease area at 3331 South Carson Street. The property is zoned retail commercial which has a 45-foot height limit. Therefore, the proposed 70-foot tower requires approval of a special use permit as it exceeds this height limit. The lease area will house the proposed monopole as well as equipment cabinet to house battery packs to provide backup power to the site. The applicant has confirmed that there will be no generator on site. A personal storage and retail office complex is currently operated at this location. The property is surrounded on three sides by commercially zoned properties with residentially zoned properties to the east. So this is an overall site plan. The lease area is in the northern, near the northern property line, approximately midway between the front and rear property lines. And this just depicts the lease area. It includes the tower and equipment cabinets, and the lease area will be fenced and gated for security. As I'm sure you all recall, this was originally scheduled to be heard by the Planning Commission at the January 30th, 2019 meeting. However, staff did request a continuance at that time to continue to work with the applicant on the aesthetics of the tower. As you can see from this slide and the next, the applicant is proposing the use of a radome, which is that cylinder that essentially it conceals the individual antennas to provide more of a stealth appearance. Additionally, the applicant will be required to paint the tower a neutral color, such as tan. So this photo simulation is the view from Carson Street. And this is the view from the residential neighborhood to the east. And the tower appears in both of those slides on the bottom photo simulation. There's also additional photo sims in your packet. Carson City Development Standards Division 1.9 outlines the requirements for wireless telecommunication facilities. A detailed summary of how this application meets the standards is included in your staff report, and I'd be happy to go over any of that in detail if the Planning Commission has questions. So we have gotten some inquiries, both from the Planning Commission as well as the public, on the status of a special use permit that was approved in 2015 for Verizon. This was for an 80-foot tower to the south of the Fandango Casino and the hotel. The chair did ask that I include a slide showing the location. So as I stated, this is an 80-foot monopole utilizing a similar design to the tower that's before you this evening. The tower was never built, and the special use permit expired. Based on our research and discussions with the applicant, we're unsure as to why this never moved forward. So getting back to this evening's request, as you all know, there are 7 findings of fact that the Planning Commission must make in the affirmative in order to approve a special use permit. Based on public comments we've received, I believe we have 20 of them now that you all have copies of. I'm going to focus on finding 2, which requires that a finding be made that the project will not be detrimental to the use, peaceful enjoyment, economic value, or development of surrounding properties or the general neighborhood, and will cause no objectionable noise, vibrations, fumes, odors, dust, glare, or physical activity. Staff was able to make finding 2 in the affirmative because the ground-mounted portions of the facility will be screened from view with existing vegetation and buildings. The visual impact from the portion of the structure that extends above the existing buildings will be minimized with the use of the radome to conceal the individual antennas. Additionally, the tower will be required to be painted a neutral color. The tower also exceeds the minimum setbacks from the residentially zoned properties. Division 1.9 of the development standards requires a setback 4 times that of the height from any residentially zoned properties, which would require, in this case, a 280-foot setback. This tower is a little over 400 feet from the residentially zoned properties to the east. And finally, the applicant provided a noise study with the application. That noise study indicated that the noise generated from the facility will be approximately equivalent to rustling leaves or refrigerator humming, and that is outside noise once you're in the building, in a building. Obviously, there's some noise attenuation. After discussions with the applicant, staff is recommending changes to condition 13 to help clarify the language. The modified condition would read, the applicant shall reasonably allow for co-location of at least one other provider's antennas on the structure, limiting the costs to the providers to a fair and equitable share of the ground lease, design, capital costs for construction, and reasonable maintenance consistent with industry standards. I would ask that you please incorporate this change into any motion for approval. And with that, I'll conclude my presentation. Matt Moore is here representing the applicant, and he may wish to address the commission, and I'm available for questions.
Questions for staff? Seeing none, would the applicant like to come forward, please? Welcome. First of all, would you state your name, please, for us?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Matthew Moore. I am an authorized agent of Verizon Wireless and the applicant for our Fandango project here. Rather than reiterate staff's presentation, which was fantastic, I'd like to kind of preemptively address some of the questions or kind of concerns that might be here with this project. For starters, in regards to the previously approved project with the expired permit, I was able to do some extra digging. It was handled initially by a different site acquisition firm than mine, so we just don't get all of the paperwork in those transitions. The indications were that... I didn't realize it wasn't plugged in. Sorry.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. So indications were that there were, 6 months to a year of contractual negotiations and the terms, they couldn't come to terms, and so they had to let the permit expire, and Verizon wouldn't put the time and money to secure the permit and then just abandon it for no reason. I work for a site acquisition firm. Like I said, there are many companies like mine, and the way that these things work is Verizon's radio frequency engineers find deficiencies within the network, either gaps in coverage or existing facilities are being overloaded by user traffic and shutting down. And so what they'll do is they will print out what's called a search ring, and it's just a circle on a map, and they will send that to firms like ours and say, we need a tower here somewhere in the ring. The search ring for this particular project was issued in 2013. Again, it was with another firm. They found a site. Things fell through in the contract negotiations. My company picked the project up in 2017, about midway through 2017. Same search ring, same search area. We pinged all of the properties that were appropriate. We look for four main things. We need a ready and willing landlord who's willing to work with Verizon. It has to work for the Verizon radio frequency engineers. It has to abide by local zoning regulations, and it has to be constructible. We have to be able to build it and get our utilities to there. And so within the search ring itself, we thoroughly scrubbed the ring. It is always our preference. We're not insensitive to the fact that people want these facilities to be further away from their neighborhoods, but the reality is sometimes we can't find other properties, and just the way that the technology works, they do have to be relatively close to the areas that they're intended to serve. And so for this project, the intent is to cover a gap in coverage along Highway 50 to maintain continuity of coverage, bring additional coverage to the commercial and residential areas that do have deficient coverage, and also alleviate traffic from other existing facilities in the surrounding areas that are being overloaded by user traffic and starting to suffer functionality issues. Additionally, I know that there were some current concerns about the design. We did show the ray dome just to cover up the antennas. I think it was maybe on Friday. I also sent Heather a batch of photo sims showing the facility as a monopine. I think that it looks really good from a screening standpoint, but I want everybody to be aware that in order to make it look like a monopine, we have to add about 7 additional feet to the overall height. We have to put a crown on there to kind of keep it realistic looking. And that's all I have for now, but I'll gladly answer any questions.
Okay. First of all, you're to accept the conditions as written with the modification of number 13?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Going back with a little, I was here for the earlier one, and we were always sensitive to our entrances into our town as far as, you know, where these go, et cetera. And compliments, for example, the one on Stewart Street that's the water tower. I mean, it really, I think, looks quite good there. I do appreciate here the fact that you're using center of the location, so the building's blocking all the lower stuff, et cetera. Obviously, across the way, it wouldn't have affected as many houses in the other location, but it's sitting in a parking lot there as well. So, but anyway, that was my only comments. But any other questions for the applicant? Commissioner Tingle.
So you made reference to coverage area of Highway 50.
Yes.
Is that Highway 50 from 395 South going up to the lake? Is that Highway 50 from Carson Street east?
Highway 50 immediately around our project. We have pretty good coverage to the north, so it is further to the south along Carson Street there. There are two facilities, 1.4 miles to the north and 1.4 miles northeast of our proposed location. Part of this facility's objective is to offload capacity from those. So it's to cover the immediate area and to offload those.
Okay, because it would seem to me that if you are looking at covering Highway 50 corridor coming down from Lake Tahoe to 395, that it would make a little bit more sense to utilize the Casino Fandango location than it would this one, but that's just a personal observation. I'm just kind of a little bit confused about why you're looking at covering a Highway 50 corridor when you're like not close to Highway 50.
They were, both locations were in the search ring, and so both were flagged as meeting the intended coverage objectives. The Fandango Casino was the initial choice, but it fell through. In terms of trade-off, the radio frequency engineers said that this site works just as well for their objectives. If it didn't, we would not be here today, I promise.
So, again, looking at the different angles, with the building, existing buildings, if you're looking at a 70-foot tower, you probably have, what, about the top 40 feet of that extended above the house, the buildings or whatever? Okay. And if they were to make it a tree or something, you just would add another 7 feet.
Yes, and I mean, this is a representation of the facility as a 77-foot tall monopole. Or monopine, sorry.
For the applicant. Seeing none? Oh.
Mr. Borders. The determination of how tall it needed to be.
Yes, sir.
I'm sure it was a gradient. You print these coverage maps based on 5-foot increments or so, and you look for the best coverage you can get
when we receive
the altitude that you need.
When we receive our search rings from the RF engineers, they just put a minimum functional height for the antenna center line, and so you know we don't do that stuff in house. We get it directly from Verizon.
And what was the minimum functional height?
66 feet, which is the center line here.
Okay.
If someone else were to share, would this normally go up higher, or would they hang below the existing, or that would depend? Or
it would depend on what their coverage objectives were and kind of what their engineers flag as the minimum center line needed. But there would certainly be space below our antennas for co-location purposes.
And if that were to happen, staff, I'm aware that it would have to come back. If it was going to go any higher than the existing that's approved tonight, it would have to come back to us, correct?
That is correct.
Questions for staff or for the applicant? Commissioner Doors.
Commissioner Doors, for the record. For staff, you had said if the next co-lease is 10 feet or less higher than this proposed one, it doesn't have to come in front of us again, correct?
So there's three different measures, essentially. So one is if it doesn't increase the height by 10 feet, One is if it doesn't increase the height at all, and one is if it increases the height of a structure that already exceeds the height limit. So this would already exceed the height limit, and it would have to come back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, at this point, we'll open this for public comment. If you would come forward and state your name when you get to the microphone, and remember to hit your button and see the green light. Appreciate it. Thank you. Seeing that quite a few of you are probably here, how this normally operates, we will listen to the public comment, and we won't respond as it's being given. We will try to answer or address any concerns or questions after it's all been presented.
My name is Daniel Knox. My name is Daniel Knox. I reside at 346 Springview Drive here in Carson City with my wife, and I'm respectfully requesting that Carson City Planning Commission deny Special Use Permit 18-166 based on the following. Number one, I object that this tower will detract from my unobstructed view of the mountains. I believe that this obstruction will have a negative impact on my property values. To believe that painting a cylindrical radome and supporting structure will mitigate the visual impact of the tower is absurd. I had submitted information to staff concerning a stealth approach to the antenna array by utilizing a look-alike pine tree structure. It would minimize the visual impact because it would blend with other pine trees that are within a very close proximity. Verizon and other carriers have done this with other sites when it was a requirement of officials. If the commission were to approve the height increase from what now is a 45-foot limitation, future co-location requirements will dictate an increase in height to accommodate additional carriers. The FCC encourages carriers to enter co-location agreements, and so does the city. But those incremental increases of 10 feet, as stated in the staff report, are not a maximum for a co-location partner. The FCC allows each co-location separation not to exceed 20 feet. Therefore, it is possible that this tower could eventually reach 110 feet in height. Item 3. Statistics are widely available that what has happened when just the perception of what effects a cell tower's transmission can cause on health. Studies prove property values can diminish by more than 10% when a cell tower is in close proximity. If approved, this cell site will impact my property value. Item 4. Verizon submitted a noise study report that did not include a generator. Submittals include the electrical service connection for a generator and claiming the generator is only exercised once each week. A contrary statement notes that the applicant confirms that a generator is not proposed at this site. Therefore, for clarification, I request that an additional requirement for approval be added that specifically states a generator will not be located at this location throughout the life of the project, and I think that's reasonable. Lastly, another site, as was already mentioned, has already been approved to Verizon, and I know it's expired, but specifically the original Fandango project, which was special use permit 15-095, that approved an 80-foot monopole located at 3910 South Carson Street. So therefore, I believe the Planning Commission should directly ask Verizon why this new proposed site has preference over an already approved site with the same coverage map. Lastly, I ask each and every member of this board that if you vote to approve this 70-foot structure over objections by me and others, we implore you to include a requirement that it be camouflaged as a pine tree design. And I thank the Planning Commission for the opportunity to express my concerns. And I would also like to add for the record, this is U.S. Code of Federal Regulations having to do with co-location. And this on page 2 states that they can go up to 20 feet for each co-location in height, not 10 feet. And I thank you.
Thank you, sir. More public comment?
Hi, my name is Michael Nubbins. I live at 310 Sandalwood Drive, and this project definitely affects my property and the potential value of my property. Even if it's hidden as a pine tree, it will still exceed all the pine trees on Sandalwood Drive based on the picture that was shown up earlier. And this indeed would affect our property, as everyone coming down that on Sandalwood heading west will see this huge fake pine tree, and it will decrease the value of our properties. And we also noted that there is electromagnetic energy that is made by the cell tower. Now, your staff has said there is no detrimental health issues. Now, I'm not sure about that. I don't know how much study was put into this. I am pacemaker dependent, and I am concerned. I can't even carry a cell phone in my chest pocket anymore, and I can't use my left ear to use my cell phone because of the problems it causes with the pacemaker. And I'm wondering if your staff has actually looked into this at a reasonable level and talked to cardiologists and pacemaker manufacturers. So I'm against this location, and if it was to go any higher than the 90 feet or whatever they're talking about now, it would even decrease our property values more. I would like the board to say no to this project, and if they do approve it, to limit it to the 45 foot. Other words, find another location. I mean, you have the location at the Fandango. We have a city park over by Costco and Bodine's, closer to Highway 50, as Ms. Tingle had mentioned earlier. And I feel that just the location so close to residential on the east side that the project should be denied. No one has talked about the time of the project to build it and the noise level and the possible pollution. The floodplain is right below, back on the east side of the project, which is basically just a water, like a pool. And I don't know if that would affect the project or not, but I'm requesting that the application be denied. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
My name is Gabe Erich.
Make sure it's green, sir. Hit the button and it should turn green right at the base of the stem. Here you go.
My name is Gene Erskine. I own property at 3149 South Carson. I've been in business there for 40 years under the house, trade name House of Drake. And I've been in electronics for that 40 years. And I honestly can't understand why that Verizon on December the 15th, 2016, were approved for an 80-foot tower. And they have never used that approval. They've never used the, and I don't know why, because this was in a location much more desirable for their type of operation over behind Carson Gaming. And I can only say that if this is allowed to go in the location that's stated, there will be an awful, awful lot of very unhappy people, because there's a large mobile home park there. There's the storage facility where this is to go has some 200 and some people entering and leaving every day for their storage. And I can only say that they should, what I would like to say is that the state of Nevada owned or controlled South Carson Street up until just less than a month ago, I guess. And then they turned South Carson Street back over to Carson City. Now, the reason they did this is they claimed that they were going to put in a beautification committee and make lower Carson City look more like the center of Carson City, which is beautiful. And so the first thing I hear afterward is this 80-foot mousetrap to be stuck right in the middle of South Carson City is certainly not part of the beautification committee that they talked about. And if anyone here needs to be familiarized with this tower and what it looks like, let them go up Fairview opposite the National Guard Armory up there behind the bottling company and see one that's installed. And it's a real first-class eyesore. So I that's all I've got to say, but thanks for your time. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, sir.
Good evening. My name is Rebecca Jones. I live at 3328 Bonnyview Drive. My property is immediately adjacent to the property that we're discussing tonight. And I want to adamantly ask the commission to deny the approval of this because I agree with the other speakers. This is going to certainly affect the value of our property. And also, with my property being abutting the property in question, it is certainly going to detract from any attempt to use my backyard and enjoy the peace and tranquility that I know that is Carson City. I just don't believe that this commercial entity should enhance its revenue stream at the expense of the citizens. We deserve to have a comfortable place to enjoy our homes. And if there was any possibility of perhaps looking at the Fandango property again, I think we should do that because it seems to be a more logical place to put a tower of that height. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ernie Walsh, I'm the owner of the property at 393 Sandalwood, which is right at the end of the street where you're looking at the tower. I adamantly oppose this in the fact that you set up regulations within certain districts for certain things, and if they want a tower at 45 feet, let them proceed with their tower. There's not much we could do because it would be within their regulations. Your regulations, but just to, for the benefit of a few people, to impose the additional height and the eyesore, I'm glad they came with the idea of proposing a pine tree, but at 70 feet, it's still going to look very unrealistic. So, if you do approve it, I strongly recommend some of the things the other people said, that you have a condition, no generators now or ever, that I don't know why that the co-location thing, how many people can have other transmitters or the more height that is that reasonable that they can just come in and apply for another application to extend that for a co-location, more antennas?
We'll respond to everything at the end.
Okay. So it just looks to me like it's kind of an unlimited open door for co-locations. And here again, it's pretty high to be in the middle of town and pretty close to a residential. I know the setback was talked about, but even so, that's still affecting everybody east of that tower is residential. Thank you kindly.
Thank you, sir. Any more public comment? Seeing none, we'll bring it back for further discussion. As far as some of the things that were mentioned, the generator, there is not going to be a generator with this project. We can possibly address the idea of adding a condition, whatever, that no generator would be there. I actually heard from several, if it has to be there, the tree would be a better thing than just the pole, and I think that's something we can consider. As far as the view, there's no way, unfortunately, you can guarantee a view for anyone. I know we all want to keep a nice view, but if it's going to be in the view, let's try to make it as, you know, acceptable as possible. As far as the FCC controls, as far as the what's put out by these, and obviously they have to meet, this will meet whatever has to be done to be healthy and safe to be around, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not controlled by Carson City or by us. But they would not be able to put this in unless if it was a health risk to be where it was going to be within any range of the houses, the storage unit, or anything else. That would all be come under the federal people. So that's some of it. Anyone else or staff want to address any of the other items?
I think you covered all of it.
I think that covers most of it.
Commissioner Doors, I have three things. As far as adding a generator, or the as far as a provision of never adding a generator, being that putting a generator on that location probably wouldn't go against what it's currently zoned as to begin with, is that something that we're even able to do?
We could stipulate that in one of our requirements, that the generator could not be put there at any time.
We can, for sure.
I believe
because
so.
Because it's a discretionary permit, yes, we can.
Okay. The second thing, I think it's important to note, it was sort of presented as, well, this is one of the only locations that fit out of a certain number of properties. I do think it's very important to note that this is a business decision. It's not a water tower. It's not a fire department building. This is a business decision. So it's one of the properties that works for a business, and I think that it's important to keep that distinction. And then the third thing I wanted to bring up in hearing that, I think that the commission does understand that the property across the street, the deal seemingly fell through. I think we all understand that that can happen. But I think it's sort of important. I just want to go on the record as I agree that it's important to maybe revisit that. They had approval in a place where it was far less impactful on the community, and both sides couldn't work together to make it happen. That doesn't mean that anybody is obligated to approve a separate property. So I wanted that on the record. That's not really a question. That's all I got right now. Thanks.
One other item as far as the stacking or additional, they could hang anything below that in the tree or whatever it is without having to come back here. If they want to add anything that adds more than 10 feet going up, it has to come back to the Planning Commission for approval. So we're only approving the 70-foot or 77-foot if it was a tree. That's all they would be getting approval on tonight. So if they had to do anything different, they could hang all they wanted below, which has been done and can be done. But if it went up, it would have to come back to the Planning Commission.
That's correct. Any increase in height over what's approved tonight, if it's approved, would require an additional special use permit.
I think it's a misnomer to say 10 more feet.
No, it's any addition.
If we say that the tower can only be 67 feet and 3/4 of an inch, anything above that requires a new permit. Yeah, comes back, regardless of what the statute says, because this is a special condition.
And obviously, Commissioner Preston.
Working with the state and working with emergency resources, one of the most difficult things of any area is getting coverage for instance, the emergency NHP, you know, anything that can happen, fire, earthquake, whatever. And typically, when some of those things happen, the power is out and a generator is needed. So my question is on this, is that a lot of times they like to co-locate on an existing tower. And if we put down the condition that at no time can there be a generator used on this site, then it eliminates it for emergency services. So I think I have a concern about that.
Is that, but even if it has a battery pack situation there?
It does have a battery pack.
But it only goes for a certain amount of time.
Do we have any information on the battery pack and how useful it is from the applicant?
Yeah. Would you come forward on that again for us, please? Thank you. I think the battery pack takes the place of the generator.
So at this site, there are two battery packs. And so what will happen if power goes out, the batteries will kick in. With our antennas and the setup here, it's relatively small, so the battery pack could last anywhere from 12 to 24 hours. But Commissioner Preston is correct. It is set up so that in times of emergency, we can roll a generator in and plug it in for the purpose of keeping the facility running. And I believe, I didn't look over the code provision specifically for Carson City, but every other jurisdiction that I've worked in has provisions where in emergency times or power outages and things like, the noise standards are set aside. And so the absolute only time Verizon would bring a generator to this site is if power went out and there was an emergency. And so if you're going to craft something, please take that into consideration as well.
So if we put that in there, would that mean that the site wouldn't work for you as well then, obviously?
No, it would work until the power goes out, and then it won't work. And that becomes more of a local problem until the infrastructure.
I guess what I'm asking, if we were to add the absolutely no generator through the life of the project, would that cause you to maybe consider moving that or not doing that project if that were put in?
I would have to run it by Verizon. I've never seen a condition where we're not allowed to bring one in during emergencies. So it would be a first time going over that for me.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Any other questions while he's there?
And if I could provide
Commissioner Eschwein?
I just wanted to provide one more point of clarification. The height for the zone is 45 feet, but the code does provide that wireless facilities are allowed in these zones at the minimum functional height up to 120 feet. So while we are reaching the height for the zone itself, we're still within the code in terms of how wireless facilities are supposed to be designed and sited.
I forgot what I was going to say.
I'm sorry.
I have one question. One is, if we were to require it as a pine tree, how would that affect the additional co-locations? Is it feasible to actually co-locate on a pine tree structure?
It is, and in terms of these facilities, I know people were talking about water tanks and stuff. The monopines are really the best for the co-location, because you can stick them into the dense branches already, add additional antenna socks, and you're really not going to be able to tell the difference between this facility as it is now and with one or two additional carriers. With the water tank, if you fill up space within that tank, then the only option is you start mounting antennas on the legs and stuff like that. And so unless you want a 30-foot, you know, tall tank itself that can accommodate multiple carriers, this is the best option.
And from talking to staff, a water tank wouldn't work here because the footprint's not big enough.
I would have to look at that, but it
would be real close, I think, what we were looking at. But the pine seems to be a solution more acceptable than what we were showing. Commissioner Wiggins. Go ahead. You were still going?
My other comment.
Oh, you remember.
Yes, I did.
Sure. How do we know the quality of this monopole that's going to look like a pine tree? In other words, are we going to end up with Charlie Brown's tree, or are we going to have a quality-looking tree? How can you? I saw this, of course, but of course, once you get up close to it, it's probably going to look a lot different.
Sure, and there can be some variation because essentially what we'll do is bid these out to vendors that build the things. But if you'd like, you can add a condition that requires us to submit material samples of the bark and branching beforehand, so you'd be able to see exactly what it looks like.
Okay, and would you be okay with some provision that said no diesel generator on site except for portable emergency generators brought on site?
I believe it would be acceptable. I'm not the ultimate okay in this stuff, but
I think the concern is that the diesel generator on site, they have to be run regularly.
Sure.
They're very loud. The other alternative is we put in a decibel limitation to this permit.
Sure. So, and I apologize. I think part of that confusion is on my part. Initially, we were looking at a generator here, so I included that, blurb in my initial write-up. And then when we removed the generator, I didn't remove the blurb. Everything that you guys are looking at is per the site plans that you have. We're not putting a generator on the site.
Okay, thanks.
So I think that would probably work if we put it was only allowed on there, brought on for an emergency, not left on site.
Yeah, that was going to be my comment, is that if you were to prohibit a generator altogether, then you would be prohibiting that property owner from bringing in a generator also when he needed a generator. So I think that requiring it or allowing it only during emergency situations would be appropriate in a condition.
Okay. Any other comments?
That would be specifically for this. So that would be, now I see you brought something else up. But would that be specifically for the cell tower, or would the owner be able to use a generator for something else?
The owner could bring one in anyway.
Okay.
I think.
So this is just specifically for the cell tower.
This would be for this.
Okay.
This would be attached to this use permit.
Perfect. Thank you.
So just so we're clear on what we intend.
What we're looking at thus far, I believe, is that the tree would be the preference, with bark and branch samples, et cetera, that possibly if a generator is not located on site, could be brought on site and used in emergency situations.
Yes.
If the battery packs, whatever. And what else do we have?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Who would be reviewing those bark and branch samples and making that determination?
I would think that would be staff, wouldn't it? I don't know.
I mean, it would have to be staff unless it were going to come back to us. And
Heather?
Mr. Eswine's correct. It would have to be staff unless you want a condition requiring it to come back to the planning commission
for approval. I
don't think
we need to bring it back to us.
May I make a suggestion?
Sir, yeah.
Sorry.
There's a technicality with the law. I'm sorry, Dan Knox for the record, 346 Springview Drive. There is a term called a shot clock, which I'm sure this gentleman's aware of. There is a timing period from the time the application submitted to either it's approved or denied. And there's legal ramifications if we exceed that. So I don't know when this was approved, but if there's going to be an evaluation of the monopole, bark colors and so forth, it needs to be done in a timely manner before that shot clock expires. Thank you. Maybe you could collaborate.
Just a point of clarification. The shot clock is contingent upon the jurisdiction making a final determination on the application. So your action here today would necessarily be that final action. We can send them this stuff after the fact.
Okay, good.
Does that help?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your input. Well, plus the additional language on condition 13. that would be part of it. So does anyone want to further discussion? Do you want to take a shot at this? Or? No?
No. I'm making some notes.
It was just a minute.
Mr. Chair, I can summarize what I think I heard from the commission.
I was hoping you'd say that. Thank you.
I think in terms of condition number 7, you're looking to modify that condition, which, and so it would state that the plan submitted for the building permit shall incorporate the use of a pine tree, the bark samples, and what's the other sample?
Branching
shall be submitted to the planning staff in advance of submittal of a building permit for approval of the specifications. You're also looking for a modification to condition 13 per the staff's recommendation and an additional condition which would state that a generator may not be used except during emergencies.
Well, what would be located on site full-time would be brought in case of emergencies. Is that more how it would work?
We could certainly say that generator shall not be maintained on the lease site except during emergencies.
Yes, that sounds good. I was just going to say, if we're going to approve it as the monopine, and I may have missed this, then 14 should be amended as
77,
well. 77.
77 feet to cover the dome. It's good to hear also that if someone were then coming on, it's easier to do that with the tree than if it were the other. So, okay. Now, does someone want to? If you're willing.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that we approve SUP 18-166 based on the findings and subject to conditions of approval contained in the staff report, including the three modifications that we previously discussed. You want me to specify them again, or I think?
I believe there were four modifications with one for, modification
one for height,
of 14.
One for height, one for generator. The generator, one for the condition 13 and one for the pine tree.
Correct.
Okay.
Four. Condition 7, 13, 14, and an additional condition that a generator will not be maintained on the lease site except during emergencies.
Yes, ma'am. That's my motion.
We have a motion. We have a second.
I'll second it.
We have a second from Commissioner Preston. All in favor? Aye. Opposed?
No.
Two nays
and five ayes, correct? Thank you. No?
I'll quote my finding. I find that it doesn't meet the finding of fact that it will not negatively impact surrounding property values, amongst other things, but that is certainly the big one for me.
Thank you.
I guess for this, let me state the appeal process for this. This is a special use permit that's been approved by a split vote. It says this is the final decision on a special use permit unless appealed to the Board of Supervisors within 10 days from today, which usually ends up actually being 11 days the Monday following. But if you have a question on how to make an appeal, contact the Planning Division office to get that information.
Moving on, public hearing E3, SUP-19, SUP-19-003 for possible action to consider request for a special use permit to construct a detached garage that results in accessory structures that exceed 75% of the size of the primary structure and 5% of the lot area. The subject property is located at 1777 Racetrack Road, APN 010-66-211.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hope Sullivan, Planning Manager. This is a request for a 1,681-square-foot detached garage. The subject property is 1.09 acres. If you went out to look at the property, it was a little tricky to find it. It was at the corner of Racetrack and Bigelow without a number that's easily visible, so you had to go by Schultz Ranch. But hopefully you were able to find it and see the setting. The applicant is proposing a height of 22 feet and 3 inches for this building. With this building, the cumulative square footage of the accessory buildings will be 152% of the size of the primary residence and 5.4% of the lot area. Per Section 1805 of the code, when the cumulative square footage of accessory buildings exceeds 75% of the size of the primary structure, it can only occur subject to a special use permit. Additionally, for lots that are greater than half an acre, if the cumulative square footage of the accessory buildings is in excess of 5%, it's subject to a special use permit. When the Planning Commission considers a special use permit, you're considering the 7 findings of fact. Staff has reviewed those findings of fact in the staff report, and we have been able to make those findings in the affirmative. Also, I believe in the packet is a letter of support from a neighboring property owner. Architect Jeff Frame and Don Warden and Holly Hawkins are all here on behalf of this application. I'm happy to go in depth on any of the findings, but I think the larger building is appropriate at this site and won't have it, and I can find the findings in the affirmative. Thank you.
Questions for staff?
I have one question. Where is the floodplain for Clear Creek in relationship to the building itself?
I'm referring that question to Stephen Pote.
Stephen Pote, Development Engineering, for the record. So there is a floodway and an AE flood zone that follows Clear Creek and that crosses Bigelow. And there is FEMA's zone X shaded that does go onto the property that does not restrict construction. The ones that we're worried about are the floodway and the zone AE, which are quite a ways away. I'll measure that for you while we're here.
It may not restrict construction, but would he then be required to get flood insurance if that was placed on the property?
No.
Oh.
Access wouldn't be impaired based on that location?
Correct.
Thank you. Other questions for staff? Seeing none, would the applicant like to come forward, please?
For the record, Jeff Frame, architect with Frame Architecture. The applicant's submitting. I think it's in the packet why he's doing it. He's got some custom cars and an RV that he'd like to store on site. Right now, one's stored off site, and one's actually stored in the existing garage. One of the things that's offsetting the percentages of accessory buildings to the house is the existing garage is a detached garage. It's their only garage. So other than that, I thank staff for all their help in the presentation, and we're here to answer any questions.
There's the existing garage, and we have a couple other smaller storage-type units. Yes, also, the 17 conditions, you're okay with all of those?
Yes, we are.
Written. Thank you. Questions for the applicant? Seeing none. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you.
Bring it back for... Oh, yes, thank you, sir. Sorry. Again, any public comment on this item? Seeing none, we'll bring it back for further discussion or a motion.
I'll make a motion.
Commissioner Doors.
Commissioner Doors, for the record, I move to approve SUP-19-003, a request for a special use permit for accessory buildings to exceed 75% of the size of the primary residence and 5% of the lot area on property zoned mobile home 1 acre, located at 1777 Racetrack Road, APN 010-662-11, based on findings and subject to conditions of approval contained in the staff report.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
A second.
From Commissioner Tingle. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Nope. 7-0. Thank you. Good luck. Moving on, E4, SUP-19-006, for possible action to consider a request for a special use permit to allow for advertising signage in excess of what is allowed by Carson City Municipal Code in conjunction with a two-unit mobile home complex in the existing Capital Village subdivision. The Capital Village subdivision is located on the northwest corner of Fairview Drive and South Solomon Road, APNs 009-81301, 009-81501, 009-81322, 009-80301, 009-80401, 009-81601, 009-83229, 009-83112, 009-83122, 009-83123, and 009-83242. I think that's the most...
Heather Ferris, again, for the record. Division 4 of the development standards contains provisions for signs within a residential zone. However, in the event the signage will not meet those requirements, a variation to the regulations and standards may be permitted subject to approval of a special use permit. The applicant owns the remaining 41 undeveloped lots in the Capital Village Plan Unit Development. All of these lots are on the interior of the development, and the signage is proposed to help advertise and direct people to the vacant lots and the model homes. This map shows the location and type of signage. The signage includes two banners, one at the entrance and one along the eastern property line, one entry directional sign, one double-sided directional sign at the northeast corner of the development along South Solomon Road, and five smaller directional signs on the interior of the development. Additionally, there will be flags located at the entrance and at each of the model homes. This is a sample of the proposed signage. Staff was able to make all required 7 findings in the affirmative as detailed in the staff report. We are recommending approval subject to the conditions of approval included in the staff report. And Mike, I'm sorry I forgot your last name. Sabo with Florsheim Homes, and he's here and may wish to address the Planning Commission, and with that, I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Questions for staff, Commissioner Borders.
With the new changes that we just made to the sign ordinance about banners and flags, and are these signs going to comply with that, or is he asking for a variance for his flags? Because I thought we just eliminated flags.
So it's for a special use permit beyond what is allowed in the residential zonings.
Okay.
I believe the banners and flags, without referencing the code, I believe the banners and flags section speaks specifically to commercial zone districts.
Aren't the banners and flags for this inside the property, not on the outside corners? Like, isn't that where the other signs are going to be?
Question of where the signs are going to be. Just going back to the previous question real quick, Lee Plummel, Community Development Director, the amendments you're talking about to the sign ordinance removed flags from exempt signs. And so we were in the exempt sign section, so those flags are no longer exempt exceptions for placing them in commercial districts. But as she said, it doesn't prevent somebody from getting a special use permit and using, adding flags in other cases.
All right. I just wanted to make sure we were consistent, that's all. Commissioner, next one.
Will sign A, as proposed, will that replace the existing sign at the northeast corner of this project?
I believe that is the sign that's currently at that location.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions for staff? Nope. Would the applicant like to come forward, please?
For the record, my name is Mike Tabo. I'm representing Florsheim Homes.
Thank you. And you're accepted for all the nine conditions of approval or whatever are fine with you?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Anything you'd like to add to what they have already stated? Or?
No, I think they stated it quite well. I think we're.
And the main reason for this is from the location and with the walls, et cetera, around the property, it's hard to get to those, so I could see why, you know, you're requesting us to get let people know they're there and where the mobile or the model homes are. Any other questions for the applicant? Nope. Seeing none, thank you, sir.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you for listening.
Formality, any public comment on this item? Seeing none?
I'm confused. Okay. if sign A is already installed, and sign A is just a one-sided, I believe it's just a one-sided sign on the fence, this one indicates that it's going to be, you're going to be able to see it from coming from the north or the south. Are they going to turn the sign around? So
is sign A one-sided currently? Okay, I missed that when I went by it today. So it will be an additional double-sided.
Okay, thank you.
I have one procedural question. That this permit's good for 18 months?
Or until the last lot sold.
Until the last lot sold.
That's correct.
At the end of 18 months, can they come and renew this, or is it another permit? How would that proceed?
I believe they would have to come back before the commission for another special use permit.
Could we set that just for review rather than if he needs more time or to avoid? No?
I don't have a preference. I'm just curious.
I'm just, would he have to pay again if he comes back?
I would guess.
Mr. Chair, that condition concerning the 18 months was very important to the staff. The staff was not prepared to support this application without a sunset clause. We recognize the applicant's interest in selling those homes. We recognize the challenge given the walls and the configuration of the site. So we recognize all that. We don't want to give these signs with no time limit. And so that's why the 18 months is there. Should the signs need to remain for more than 18 months, it would be a revision to the special use permit subject to review by the Planning Commission. And, yes, the fee would be 75% of the fee of the special use permit.
Okay. All right. I'm just asking. Thank you. Any other comments or a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move to approve SUP 19-006. Based on the findings and subject to the conditions of approval contained in the staff report.
We have a motion from Commissioner Borders. We have a second.
Second.
Second from Commissioner Doors. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Good luck. It's all right. We're going to take a short break. Like 5 minutes before we go into the next item. All right, we're back in business. Next item, E5, for discussion only, a presentation by the Public Works Division regarding a water use analysis conducted for projected water use and delivery needs for the master plan city build-out scenario. Lee?
Yeah, just brief introduction before Dan with Public Works introduces Eddie with the water department to give the presentation. I just want to introduce this and say this is a long-awaited for the Planning Commission. I know we've said we've had this, going to come for a while, long-awaited water capacity analysis. This is really hot off the press with data coming in. I mean, they've gone through and truth, you know, and really quality controlled it from the water side. You know, I'll tell you from our side and linking this with our land use and the master plan and the number of units, I think we still need to do some work on that. And actually because they actually went beyond what the master plan in some cases and the numbers I gave them said that they've gone like all possible development on all properties beyond what's kind of really in the master plan right now. So it's a really conservative estimate that they've done, meaning it's accounted for probably more development than our current zoning and master plan would allow. But they've taken this very technical document that you have in your packet, and I think they've put together a really good presentation for you to summarize it. So I'll turn it over to them with that.
Great. Good evening, Commission. Dan Stuckey, as we mentioned, Dan Stuckey, City Engineer for the record. I'm joined here by Eddie Qualiari. He's our water manager, our water expert for the city. I'll let him talk a little bit more about his background when he gets up to talk, but we're really fortunate to have somebody with his level of expertise at the city. He's been here about 6 months now. It's a great addition for Carson City. We thought the crowd at the beginning was for us to talk about water. So we're surprised they all left. I would consider myself a water nerd, and Eddie is ultra water nerd. So as Lee mentioned, it is technical. The documents that you saw, it is very technical. We're going to try to, if you guys want to dive into the weeds, we can definitely do that, but we're going to try to keep it at a high level, and it's late. So we're going to try to crank through this pretty fast, and hopefully you guys stay interested in it all. So here's just a quick outline. As Lee mentioned, the water usage study, I'm going to go through, again, at a very high level, the methodology that was used and the results of that study. And then I'm going to turn it over to Eddie. We like to take the opportunity, as I mentioned, we're water nerds. We think it's a great opportunity always to talk about our water view, our water system, a quick overview of that, our water portfolio. And then, this usage study kind of ties into our plans for the future, to building a smart future for the city. So Eddie's going to touch on all those towards the end. The purpose of the water usage study. So I want to make it really clear. We're constantly planning. We're always doing projections. So this is really nothing that we haven't done in the past. But with technology the way it is and the way we did this, it's at a level of detail that's more sophisticated than anything we've ever done in the past. And I'll explain a little bit of that. But really, it's going to serve... we always talk about living models versus like a report you get and you just put on your shelf and never touch again. As Lee mentioned, the goal of this is to link it not only with our land use planning, but also with our hydraulic model and have all this integrated. So it's a living, we call it the living model. So it's constantly getting updated as we move, as we look at these developments and move along. So that's really kind of the goal of it, but it's going to help. It looks at the existing water usage and then projects that on in the build-out scenario. As I mentioned, technology, we were able to leverage a lot of big data sets, historical water usage at a parcel scale. So it's pretty detailed. And then we use GIS systems to do like spatial analysis. So not only knowing the total amount of water usage that we project in the future, but also spatially where that demand is going to be. And that's a big value to us as far as planning for infrastructure and those types of things. And then, I kind of hit on this, but, you know, just as we come to you and make some decisions and as we move in the future approving developments, this will constantly get updated. So just another nice tool to have for us on the planning side. So I broke it down on a very micro level of what this study does. Here's an example, medium density residential house here that you can see. And really what this study did was look at two things. We looked at annual water usage, so you can see the little graph there. We analyzed all the meter data over a period of 2014, 2015, 2016, and 2017, so 4 years of data. We looked at annual usage, as this kind of relates to water rights. We have a certain amount of water rights that we can produce every year, and so we wanted to look at annual water usage at a parcel scale, and so that's what you see there. And then we also look at peak day demand in those summer months, because just to give you a feel here, and it shows on this graph, you can see the months starting at January and then going throughout the year. And you guys know this, but like for right now in the winter months, we produce about 6 million gallons per day, and that'll go up to about 18 during the summer months. So from a production side, we need to be able to meet that demand in those summer months. So when we looked at these individual parcel data sets, we looked at annual usage, and we also looked at that peak day usage over those summer months. Then we took that, so that was a really micro-level scale. We took it across the figure on the left there. It shows the 19 different master plan land uses and how the different each color on that map on the left-hand side there is a different land use. So we did this analysis for each parcel in the city, 20,000 different parcels. I mean, obviously, this is happening very fast. We're using technology. And then we broke it down so you can see each land use has very different types of water usage. So we did a statistical analysis and basically came up with typical water usage, both in average annual demand, but also peak day demand for each of those 19 different land uses across the city. And so right now we use about 10 to 11,000 acre feet of water per year. And we'll talk about that. And then peak production in the summer months, as I mentioned, peak day is about 18 million gallons per day. So then we took that data and we started to look, how is everything going to build out? And can we apply the current trends and how we're using water today and project that out in the future. Now, we all know water trends change. And so I want to reiterate, this is an exercise. We're going to have to, every couple of years, we need to go back, reevaluate data, see what trends are, update our model for projections, because we know, there's more efficient, water-efficient appliances, different water conservation. I mean, I think that's kind of spreading across the community a little bit. So this will be constantly updated. But we use the trends that we have today. We project out in the future. So I'll show an example here, but for those vacant parcels, however they're zoned in our master plan, we apply a rate of what kind of water usage we think that we'll use in the future. And as Lee mentioned, we went into a lot of detail. So for example, if there was site constraints, terrain, where we didn't think it could quite, develop at the rate that it would, that technically per the land use it could develop, we modified the model. Or redevelopment areas, say it's not very developed now, but it has, and there's a house on a parcel, but it could fit 10 more houses. We wanted to be conservative in our water projections, so we assumed 10 houses in the future. We also looked at areas where properties are on well right now, and if they were in an area where we thought they could potentially connect in the future without, massive cost to expand infrastructure out to these very rural areas, if we thought it was realistic, we assumed that those converted to city water in the future. Again, the predictive, I'll talk a little bit about this example. This is the RV resort off Old Hot Springs Road that just happened. Last month that you guys saw that? This is a really good prediction. I couldn't believe that. This is our first test of kind of how the model predicted and then an actual example. So you can see the model predicted that when that developed, and the people that created this for us knew nothing about this. They predicted 63,460 gallons per day. The applicant came in projecting 65,000, and they have a detailed site that they're planning on doing, right? That's within 3%. Now, I don't want that's, I think, a very unique example. I was very impressed with that, but there's going to be variability. I mean, you guys know the very different variability that a site can develop and how the water use changes. But I just wanted to show you kind of an example that happened recently of what this model can do. What are the results? So if you read the report, there's basically three things that it hit on. I think Lee's shown these population projections to you guys all in the past, but 80,000 is about what we expect Carson City to build out at. you can see the range there anytime between 2055 and 2085, and that's just because there's different population growth projection rates. So when they looked at it in this report, they kind of looked at how our water usage demand might increase throughout this till 2085. So we have a good timeline there. We also, with the build-out condition, we expect to increase annual water usage by about 5,000 acre-feet at build-out. One thing, we have about 18,000-plus acre-feet of water rights secured today, which is a great thing. We have the water rights to more water rights than we actually need in the build-out scenario, according to these projections. And this is pretty closely in line with when I talked about those past studies that we've done. These numbers are pretty similar to that. They just did it kind of different ways. And then the other thing here, we're going to basically project to have to produce about 29 million gallons a day, max day demand in those summer months in the year 2085 is what we anticipate. So that's about 8.9 or 9 MGDs more than what we produce today. And we've got a variety of scenarios and plans for that. And obviously, that's happening over a long period of time. And that's where I'm going to turn it over to Eddie to kind of talk about what we're doing on the planning side.
All right. Well, Eddie Qualieri for the record. It's great to be here. It's great to work for Carson City. And it's exciting to work on such a complicated and interesting system. A little background for myself. I was in the private sector for about 10 years designing subdivisions for two of those years and then working on water and wastewater utilities for a number of 6 years. And then after the economy tanked, I went to work for the Public Utilities Commission regulating water systems and wastewater systems across the state. And learned a good deal about rates and quality of service and the different cross-section across the state of that that utilities face. After that, I spent 4 years as the water engineer there, and then I went to Division of Water Resources and worked for the state engineer as the as the engineering manager there, and did water rights and dam safety and worked with water resources. So it's nice to bring my background together here at Carson City and put it to use. It's really rewarding as a engineer, as a water nerd, as Dan said. So I'd like to, my presentation is going to kind of zoom out. It's not super hyper focused on parcel to parcel. It's kind of looking at the whole water system. It gets complex when you're looking at a development coming into a certain pressure zone, and we have to put a lot of time and effort into looking at if that zone can produce the water we need for that project. And I'd like to commend Dan on this study because it gives us a lot more information that we can use in our water model when it gets integrated into the water model on what other demands we could see in that zone. So then we can see how much capacity we actually need to account for and how much that developer needs to bring in, et cetera. So I just wanted to say that to kind of differentiate what I'm going to talk about to what Dan's model did. So now I'll get to my presentation. I'll try to get through this pretty quick. I'm going to go through kind of a lot of high-level stuff, but feel free to stop me if something doesn't make sense. So my presentation is going to focus on the quick overview on a water facility inventory. I'm going to go through a water rights versus usage scenarios, and then talk about just the diversity of the system of our water sources and its importance for resiliency when you talk about drought and whatever else happens. Going to go over the regional system. That's talking about the system from Minden to Dayton and coming through Carson City has been built and is functioning. And then I'm going to go into a little bit about the groundwater basins that we are overlapping and the health of them and kind of their resiliency and everything. And then I'm going to talk about that max day demand that Dan talked about, the 29 MGD, million gallons per day, and go through some of the projects and the planning that we're doing right now to meet those demands. We have a number of projects that we're actually currently working on so that we can get to that, so we can rest easy and breathe that we can supply development that comes in whenever it does, because you want to stay ahead of it, so as you guys know. So getting into the water facility inventory. So we have 16 pressure zones, 14 booster pump stations, 14 different water storage tanks, 31 groundwater wells. There's about six that aren't operating right now due to water quality situations at those wells. We're looking at changing that, but that's just the scenario we're working with. We have our surface water treatment plant, Quill, that has a 6.9 MGD rated capacity, but we're only actually functioning at a 1.8 MGD capacity due to water sources and water qualities at Marlette and Hobart Lake. And I'll get into that later, but we have an arsenic treatment plant at 1.44 MGD. We have the Douglas County intertie with the town of Minden. That's a 5 MGD capacity. There's 44 pressure regulating stations, and those are the stations that separate the pressure zones. So the whole city's interconnected, but it's separated, and it has to step down the pressure as it gets to the lower elevations in the valley. And then 329 miles of distribution pipe that we're constantly maintaining and fixing and replacing. As you can see, it's quite old. So this wanted to show the map of the system. You've probably seen this before. You can see the squares there, the different groundwater basins. And then you see the pipe kind of spider webbing out. That's the distribution system. And then the different shaded colors are the pressure zones that we're dealing with. And so each one of those has, you know, different demands and different ways that they're fed water. So some of the projects that I'll talk about in my later in my slides on how we're going to meet demand, some of those relate to moving water within those zones, or moving water to the zones on the west side, on the left side of that map, to be able to move that water to any zone that demands it. So, and that's, you've probably heard the east-west transmission main completion. That's what the intent of that is, to bring that water up into the Quill tank so we can move it up to the ash tank so that you can then get water to anywhere in the system from there. You can get that water there. And that's a lot of, you know, the on-the-ground operational complexities that we have to deal with. But, you know, talking in terms of planning, it sometimes gets lost. This shows just an easier graph to see. The wells scattered around, the triangles are the surface water sources that we'll be talking about for water rights and water production. The triangles on the right side are the Carson River wells, and that'll come into play here. The star at the bottom is the Sunridge Booster Station. That's where we pump water from Douglas County and town of Minden. And then the star on the upper right-hand corner is the East 50 tank, and that's our connection to Dayton or Lyon County Utilities. Water can either go into that tank from Lyon County or into it from Carson City, and that's how we trade water back and forth if it's needed. And then on the left side is the Kings, and then Ash, and then the Marlette Hobart pipeline that brings water in. So. Talking a little bit about water rights. So as Dan mentioned, 18,648 acre feet annually is in our name. Now those are spread out in the different groundwater basins, and then also spread out against the surface water sources. A total of 13,475 groundwater rights spread out amongst Eagle Valley, Dayton Valley, Carson Valley. And then 5,000 spread out amongst the river, the creeks, Kings and Ash, and Clear Creek. And then the Marlette system, those water rights are actually owned by the state. So we're not considering those part of our repertoire here. But we have access to them. We purchase that water. So the 18,000 isn't including the 5,000 from, or the, it's actually 3,000 from Marlette and then 7,000 from Franktown Creek. So that's the overview of the water rights. As you can see up there, the average demand from 2014 to 2017 was around 11,000. So I wanted to highlight a little more on the water sources that aren't shown in that last graph that are the envy of a lot of utilities that Carson City actually has. And I'd like to commend Carson City for gaining these, you know, before my time here, because they're really unique benefits that the state has allowed Carson City to take advantage of. For one, the domestic well credit. That is, if a domestic well converts to our system, we get a credit of 2 acre feet from that domestic well. So we inadvertently get an extra water rights from it. And that state engineer order 1202. State engineer order 1140 happened during a period of drought, about 10 years, from like 86 to 95. The state engineer was looking at curtailing Carson City due to groundwater levels dropping. And he actually allowed Carson City this permit to, in times of that, they could actually pump more for a one-year period if they needed to from Eagle Valley. And in those times, Eagle Valley was the main source. So now that we have a more diverse system, we don't have that problem of relying just on that basin. But in times of extreme drought, we could actually exceed our 6,000 acre feet from Eagle Valley for a one-year period with some restrictions. Another unique thing that we have the advantage of having is recharge permits. We have 2 recharge permits. One is we actually get credit for, and this is water that's coming down that Marlette pipeline. We have valving up there where we can turn it out and send it down VC Canyon, and that recharges the Eagle Valley groundwater basin. And so we're allowed to, from our permit, we're allowed to recharge it at 700 acre feet per year. And it's basically like a bank account. It's water in the bank. We can pull it out when we need to. Currently we've stored 5,000 acre feet in the Eagle Valley Basin from this activity. It's a great opportunity. Tumwa has it, SNWA has it, but Carson City may be the only other utility in Nevada that has this, scenario. The other recharge permit we have isn't growing water rights or building up a bank account, but we dilute the water in the ground. We send treated water from Quill treatment plant into wells along the college, along Winnie, and we have a number of wells there that have high uranium, so we can dilute that water with the good quality surface water that doesn't have uranium in it. So that doesn't build water rights, but it's another kind of unique situation that the water system does to help the groundwater basin and help our water quality. It avoids treatment too. So, so talking about water rights versus usage, as Dan kind of alluded to this, so 18,000 acre feet, we have allocated 1,400 to development already, and that, our usage is around 9,000 currently at 2018. The usage has dropped down a little bit. So that leaves us with a balance of 7,000 just for high level example. And that graph shows the, kind of that decreasing, demand that we're seeing. So the water portfolio, this is kind of a big topic, but, as we've talked about, so we get about 25% of our water from surface water, 75% from groundwater. And what we try to do is maximize, it's called conjunctive management. You try to maximize your surface water when it's available so that you don't have to pump your groundwater. And so projects that we're looking to in the future is trying to maximize that even more to get that level, you know, maybe next to 50-50. So we're working on projects that I'll show you later in the presentation that'll kind of get us closer to that.
Why?
Why is that?
Yeah.
Because the surface water, you know, in years like this, we should be using the surface water, right? We have plenty of snowpack. We're going to be just spilling that water, into Washoe Valley from Marlette because we just can't possibly take it. But we'd like to maximize it so that we don't have to pump the groundwater that's, you know, so that you build that groundwater level back up.
Makes sense. So the pumps obviously use energy, so that costs money.
The energy of the pumps, yeah, it's a lot cheaper to use the surface water. As well as you're resting that drought supply as your groundwater. Because in the drought, the surface water's not there. You shift that that portfolio more to groundwater, and now you're chipping into the groundwater basin that's maybe not getting recharged. So that's kind of the idea, and that's, you know, Tom Watt practices that. That's kind of the gold standard of operating utility. Again, another thing that a lot of utilities don't have, you know, Minden, Gardnerville, Douglas, they don't have surface water. So they're all reliant on their groundwater supply.
So basically, the groundwater stays there. If we aren't using it, we can use it later. If you don't use the surface water, it's just going to go away and
right,
not be used.
Right,
so that's
right, exactly. Right. That's the idea of conjunctive management. So this shows just a graphic of what I'm talking about. You have your Marlette-Hobart system. That's where the VC recharge comes into play. And then we actually pump that surface water we recharged out of the groundwater basin out of Eagle Valley. It shows the Dayton Valley, just kind of a schematic of the different sources. And kind of the highlighting here is just the uniqueness and the wide breadth of our water system and the different sources that we have to access. So just kind of put it on a graphic. This is showing the regional water system you're all probably very familiar with. The last piece of it is up there. I'll try to, it gets lost on the TV, but it's the last piece from Washington to Quill, and that'll allow us to bring that Minden water straight to where we need to get it to spread it out to the zones. Right now it goes into the lower zone and gets used and moved around and goes into some tanks, but we want to really get it up to those upper zones on the left side of the graph that I showed, or the map that you all saw. The Dayton connection is right now, it's just used as an emergency. They need water, we can give them water, they pay for it. If we need water, we take it, which we haven't, but we would pay for it. So it's just kind of an emergency connection. Just wanted to highlight that the final phase is underway this summer. So it's really exciting. It gives us a lot more flexibility and redundancy and resiliency. So next I was going to go through, I'll try to make this quick because I know you guys want to get home, but I want to go through the groundwater basins and talk about how that's managed by the state. And I would just say that the diagnosis of the basins are pretty good, I'd say, especially in lieu of some other basins throughout the state. But the idea of perennial yield, some people call it sustainable yield, safe yield, but the idea is that it's a fishbowl, that, you know, you're not over pumping the water that's being poured into the fishbowl by rain and moisture. So it's the maximum amount of groundwater that can be salvaged each year over a long term, over 100 years, without depleting the groundwater reservoir. And so you're seeing that water table not dropping year after year after year, even in average water years. You see that remain the same. And the water levels that I've seen, that it's tracked by the state. We provide monthly pumpage reporting, and we provide water level reporting every month to the state, showing, and they're tracking it to show that it's staying stable. And if it's not, that's when the state engineer comes in. He can curtail. We have a really progressive groundwater laws in the state, way more progressive than California, that's just getting their groundwater laws in place. It's on par with Utah and Idaho and Arizona, that, you know, the other dry states in the nation. Nevada is the driest state, so it has some of the best water laws. So the perennial yields is an actual number. It says, you know, 9,000 is your max. If you go over that, you're going to start depleting the basin. And that's what it means when a groundwater basin is overpumped. And currently, none of ours are overpumped. And I'll go through that in the next slides. So this is the Eagle Valley groundwater basin. Perennial yield, the first one was set in 1964 at 4,900. And you can see this is straight out of the state engineer's pumpage reports that come out every year. This information is available every year. So the latest one they have is the 2016, and you can see that the system yield, and it gets confusing here, but I'll try to explain it. The system yield is basically all the streams and creeks and everything, Clear Creek, Ash, Kings, that actually infiltrates through the basin. So the system yield, the total yield is 9,000. And you can see that we've only gotten close to 6,000 in 2013, and we've dropped every year since. The next basin is Dayton Valley, and this one actually has a range. These things are hard to kind of pinpoint, so having a range is actually probably better. A lot of it's based on USGS studies. This one was actually based on a state engineer order due to a conflict out in Dayton Valley, but it relied on testimony from a USGS employee to come up with this 8,000 to 20,000 acre foot range. And the line, so it's dramatically affected by the river and the flows in the river that's actually getting into the ground as well as just rainfall. So if you talk about perennial yield, it's you're talking about just the rainfall into the fishbowl. But this one, you know, it varies based on the river, so they have a range. And you can see, I think it's gotten up to 10,000, close to 10,000 acre feet. And this is total pumpage. This is including domestic wells. This is everyone pumping. It's gotten up to 10,000, so pretty good in that range right now. Carson Valley, the last one. This is kind of known as one of the healthier basins in the state, just as far as the groundwater table is just not changing. And it is really influenced by the Carson River through this basin. But you can see the perennial yield's pretty big. It's 49,000. It's a big basin, but it gets a lot of, snow melt and everything from the lake. And it's gotten close to 40,000. So it's still got a pretty good buffer, on this concept. And the idea with groundwater basins is in times of drought, it's really kind of drought resilient, where you don't see a big change in the water levels, you know, in the first 2 years of a drought. If a drought goes 10 years, or the last one we had was like 5 years long, you saw more of a drop. And that's when the state engineer gets involved, and the issue has to be he can curtail pumping and et cetera, et cetera. So the point is that the groundwater basins are pretty healthy, as you can see. There are controls on it. We're always watching the levels. We monitor on a daily basis our groundwater levels. So I kind of want to move into the planning of projects and kind of show you guys what the water system's currently doing to make sure we can meet these demands when they happen. It's kind of ironic because we're seeing a demands kind of decrease, even though our studies will show that, you know, a build out will have 80 some thousand people here. When that happens is up in the air, right? So, currently we're at about 20 MGD. This last year we were under that, but our max has been about 21 MGD that we've, the demands that we've seen. And at the build out, we need to add, as Dan said, 8.99 MGD to meet build out scenario of 29 MGD. The study goes into a buffer of adding 20% to it, and that's just, you know, good practice. So that would bump us up to 35 MGD if we wanted to have, you know, more redundancy and resiliency in the system so that, you know, our big producing well or our water treatment plant goes out for a while. We don't want to be left, you know, on the hook. So you want to build in, you know, some contingency in it. So these next couple of slides will show how we'll get to that in projects that we're actually currently working on today. So we're currently going to re-drill well 3, which is one of our best wells, best water quality and best producing. And that'll add 1.4 MGD. And this graph shows on the left the MGD, the demand that
Sorry to interrupt. Mm-hmm. Where is that well located?
It's on Winnie. And it's near Foothill, okay. Near the trails. There's the detention basin right there at Foothill.
Okay.
It's the one with the spigot outside. that people come fill. They fill buckets off because of the water quality is so good there.
You're going to re-drill, is just go deeper? Is it?
We're going to drill a new well.
A new well?
Yeah, a new well outside the building. So this shows that the red line is our current, what we can currently produce. It's around 24 MGD. So right now at our, you know, you can see 21.7 was our max in 14. So we had some buffer even with that. Now we're down to 18, so we have even more flexibility. But, you know, as we grow, so I show at like a 1% rate up to 2025, not very dramatic. And then you see the graph that goes up, the build out that pumps it up to 29 MGD. So this gets us, you know, bumps up that graph. And that's what this next is going to show. If we redrill, which we currently have slated for 2020 to redrill well 4. It's another really good producing well. It's just we need to find better water quality in it. Currently, we're not using it. But we think that we could, if we study it more and do a better test well, we can find better water quality in it. And there's ways you can cap off the bad water quality and just get the good water quality. So that would add another MGD to the, or a plus to the system to get us 2.8. And that's what that line shows you, getting closer to that build out. The blue line shows the two projects added together. And then we're also looking at the possibilities of adding another induction well. And that's, you know, the surface, the graph that I show, the two triangles on the right side. We have two wells that are groundwater wells, but they're pumping surface water rights. So it's just another good portfolio mixture that we have on the Carson River. So, again, it rests the groundwater tables. So we really, really have enjoyed having those supplies. And so this is a new induction well bumping it up to 4.9 MGD. And you can see with those projects that we're working on today, we're above the max day demand. You know, now we don't have the buffer still, but, you know, we're getting closer to that. And then there's Quill. So I talked earlier about how we're only using 1.8 out of Quill. We can only treat certain waters that we're getting, Kings Creek, Ash Creek, and a portion of Marlette Hobart is actually a collection system of springs called East Slope. And it's different than Marlette water. So we have a contract with Far West right now to study the treatment plant. It's an old technology that needs to be upgraded. And what this study hopefully will do is show us how much it's going to cost us to bring that treatment plant up to capabilities of pump, of treating all the water from those sources. So Marlette, Hobart, even the Franktown to Cree water that feeds into Hobart is another source. So bringing that up to adds another 4 MGD, and we could actually probably go beyond that. But that would, with those three or four projects right now that we're currently working towards, gets us to that, close to that 35 MGD, which is the build out plus the 20% reserve that the study talks about. And so this slide just shows you, I should have had this before, but it shows that, you know, we have the east-west transmission main that's coming this summer. That adds resiliency and redundancy to bring that water to the whole system. It doesn't add really capacity. And then we have the well 3 redrill that we're moving forward. Actually, it's spring now. We're not doing it in the fall. We're going to try to get it done in the spring. And then well 4, we're looking at 2020, maybe 2021 to get that one done. The induction well on the river is unknown, but we are going to start with some testing to see if there's actually water in the place that we're looking for. There's been other studies to look to the north of our wells, and they didn't find good producing areas. So we're going to look to the south and see if there's actually potential there for another induction well. And then the Quail Water Treatment Plant improvements, you know, we have a PER, preliminary engineering report, currently underway. We're just kicking it off on Monday, actually. study the treatment system, what we can do for improvements, and then what's the ultimate fix for it, for the water we're seeing water quality degradation at Marlette and Hobart. And so that's causing us issues. So that's what and that water is important because, see, I told you we're water nerds. I could go on for hours on this stuff. That water is important not only for quantity, but for blending. I told you about that recharge permit we have and blending that uranium out of the system. And it's really, we use it for a lot of different things. It really becomes important and for the resiliency of the system, which is just part of that whole portfolio that we've been talking about. So, with that, I will kick it off to Dan to close this thing out.
Yes, I'll be quick, but just to kind of summarize what we've talked about tonight, complex and dynamic water system. I mean, again, I want to reiterate Eddie's, you know, it's been great having him come on board. And just from an operations standpoint, I mean, 26 pressure zones, you look at all the different wells and we got the quill. I mean, from an operations standpoint, we got a lot of great operators here at Carson City too, a great team. Diverse water portfolio, there's a lot of advantages to that, not only groundwater and surface water, but all the different types of sources that we get. It's really good to have that diversity. We talked about, you know, needing the 16,000 acre feet annually in the future as far as water rights, and we already have over that today. And not only do we have those, but there's also coming from healthy sources, healthy basins, as Eddie mentioned, that are constantly being monitored. And then, you know, it's not just about production, but I think, you know, Eddie mentioned we're already in movement on a lot of these. Well 3 is going here soon. East-West is going to be finished this summer. So those will add, you know, production as well as just resiliency and redundancy to our system and help with some operation inefficiencies and all that. So we're constantly planning for the future. This is a great study. And with that, I'll just open it up to questions.
I'm a little confused because we were told we ended up running the line to Douglas and bringing the water in to blend it because we had to because of the arsenic levels. But then earlier in this, it mentioned we have an arsenic plant now. I thought it was to avoid having an arsenic plant was the reason we were bringing the water in from Douglas County.
So the arsenic plant is connected to well 49 and well 4. There's only two wells that are connected to the arsenic treatment plant. And so it's just treating water from those two wells. And so we haven't been running the arsenic treatment plant because we're getting that water from Minden. So it's just kind of this, should we run and pay for all these chemicals when we're getting water from Minden now?
So we're still correct in the statement by saying we're bringing it in so we don't have to run the arsenic plant.
Yeah.
Do you see any level changes coming from the feds on that again? I mean,
I hope not. We're just in a meeting with Minden today talking about that. And, you know, there was talk about moving it down to like 5, from 10 to 5. They went from 50 to 10. And there was talk 5 years ago to go even lower, but I don't think anyone could survive that, especially in the West Coast here where it's arsenic's prevalent everywhere.
So they went from 50 to 10.
To 10.
Which is like 400%.
Yeah. It was a big deal. I mean, and it was mostly unfunded. So
it seemed to hurt us growing up, but.
Yeah.
The one thing I don't see, you know, reflected in here is any kind of recharge. So as far as the effluent recharge, do we have anything on that too? Because I know that in the 70s we spent a lot of money actually putting it into doing the Eagle Valley and this and that in order to recharge the original aquifers. And I just like to see where that is, considering one of the reasons I ended up back here in Carson City was because I was in Olympia, Washington, and they wanted to know what we did in Carson. So that's something that, you know, I find that's rather unique that Carson started in the 70s, and I just wanted to see, is that still a consideration?
Yeah, as far as the golf, watering the golf courses, is that
What are you referring to?
Yeah, watering the golf courses, all the ball fields. You know, there's a lot of purple pipe in this town.
Right.
And essentially it was to take the effluent and put it in and recharge, because back in the 70s during the drought, people used to come here to play golf. They used to come play golf from Idaho all over the place because we had the only green greens around.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to do with our effluent actually recharging back into the aquifers.
Yeah.
And so
I can speak a little of that, having been involved with Eagle Valley Golf for 25 years, that the last few years there wasn't enough effluent. The city was having to change the cemetery and the schools and that back to fresh water, and because there wasn't enough for all the golf courses to even use, but hopefully that's going to change or is coming back. But
yeah,
that was part of the problem.
That's a complicated one, and there's a new wastewater utility manager, Andy Hummel, that could fill you in more. He's doing studies and stuff just on that topic, and you know it does help. It helps not putting fresh water and taking demand away from our system for the golf courses. It's another great attribute that I didn't talk about to our system. You know, we've done, you know, as you fix, it's interesting, as you fix things, you end up with less water, you know. So if you're fixing the leaky sewage pipes that would infiltrate water into them during storms, you're now getting less water on the other side for effluent. So it's kind of, as you make your system tighter, you kind of can lose, you know, it's kind of unintended consequences. But it is a huge resource. I mean, there's infiltration that the grass doesn't uptake all the water, so some of it goes into the ground. So, there is infiltration due to that, and it's something that's not reflected in those perennial yields at all.
Well, and that's,
so it's
that's
just extra.
Volume too, because Eagle Valley alone in the summer is dumping, we're dumping 2 million gallons a night on Eagle Valley Golf Course.
Yeah, so.
And then you take Silver Oak and Empire and all that, you're probably using 5 or 6 million gallons that they aren't using fresh water, so.
Right.
One of the things I just wanted to add to that, as Eddie mentioned, Andy Hummel is our new wastewater manager. He's been here about 3 or 4 months. One of his first tasks that he's going to be putting out here is we're going to be doing a master plan update on our reclaim system to kind of, like what you talked about, kind of planning for that future, looking at some different scenarios and options of what we can do to make that a more efficient system and better planning into the future. So that is actively happening right now.
Was Carson Water Subconservancy District involved in any of this discussion or information or anything?
As far as the specific study, they were not.
Any data, anything? Had they haven't been brought in on any of this?
Not on this study, but I typically, maybe Eddie can jump in. I know typically more, at least once a year, we give updates to the subconservancy on everything from our stormwater to reclaim to water systems where they're getting new data or anything that we've done throughout the year. Those happen at a minimum annually and probably even more so than that with Eddie and Andy Hummel. They're getting that information.
How do you, or how does the city hold on to water rights that it's not using when the state requires beneficial use for all water?
That's a good question. So it gets complicated quick, but I'll try to simplify it. So surface water rights can't be forfeited. The forfeiture statutes are in the groundwater statutes. So the only way a surface water right, you can lose it, is if you abandon it intentionally through the abandonment process. So the surface water rights, even if we don't use them, we're not going to lose them. Like the Marlette water, the state's not going to rip up those permits because they're a surface water source. So the groundwater permits, if you don't use that, you'll lose it. And so what we do is we manage our system so that we are always pumping our rights. We move water rights around so that we pump them to certain wells and then we move them again. And it's a constant game. And, you know, I used to do the forfeiture process at the state. so I kind of have an inside track on it. I know how it works, how it doesn't work, but, you know, it's municipalities are kind of a unique situation as far as forfeiture. They still will go after them. You know, I think I sent Carson City a few letters on some of that, and it resulted in, you know, giving the utility time to use those rights, and there's extension processes that you go through. If we were in a pinch, we could file an extension and provide good reason why, you know, why we're not using it, but why we need it in the future. So that's kind of the how there's flexibility in those statutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Moving on. F1, staff reports. Lee?
Yeah, just briefly going over some items that were before you previously and were at the Board of Supervisors in February. The Lompa East tentative planned unit development was approved by the board at the first meeting. I don't think there were any modifications to it at that meeting. I think it was actually a relatively quick item. The zoning map amendment at Hot Springs Road went through first and second reading. That was the commercial property, went through first and second reading in February, and the abandonment on Fifth Street in front of the bank saloon was approved. And also on the February meeting, gave the master plan annual report, which was accepted as recommended. And in there, again, as noted earlier, was the Title 18 review, which is going to be the big item for the Planning Commission this year to start. And that's going to be with staff trying to figure out how to go through Title 18 comprehensively to look at, and the development standards to look at some things starting this year. For next month's Planning Commission meeting on the 27th, we have a few items. We have an abandonment and related to a special use permit project for a 143 unit apartment complex down on that Voltaire Street vicinity, Cochise Street vicinity is one of the rezoning properties that you've reviewed in the last few months. And a special use permit for a dog boarding facility on South Carson Street, and a special use permit to continue a billboard. So those are the items for next month for the Planning Commission. And then the only other thing I wanted to mention is we've gotten information from the Carson High School. If any of you are interested in reviewing senior projects this year, I have some information. Just come see me. I have information, and of course, high school will be happy to have you.
Commissioner reports or comments? I'd like to make one. Welcome back, sir. That was very short-lived. I'm glad I made a couple phone calls, but glad you're here, especially going into Title 18.
We're glad you saved your name tag.
Yes.
I have one question for Lee. Lee, as we go through this Title 18, what's going to be the approval process? Will we have public hearings? Will we approve it and send it forward? You know, what's the approval process that goes with this?
Yeah, with the complete Title 18 update, I mean, obviously there's the process where you make a recommendation on, per code, you make a recommendation on Title 18, you have public hearing on that, the board approves it. I think your question may be digging deeper as we have discussions on particular sections of it. When are we going to get input? And it, you know, we haven't come up with a precise plan of even, you know, how to get through Title 18 in a, you know, you really just can't say, let's talk about Title 18 in one meeting. I mean, so we're going to have to bite it off in smaller chunks and figure out how to do that. And then at some point, our plan would be to bring the public in. And particularly if it's, for example, the commercial properties, you want to start talking to commercial realtors about what sections we're modifying, things like that. But the plan would be to bring the public in beforehand to get the input before you make the final recommendations to the DA's office and the Board of Supervisors.
Well, basically, I see it where our position is an overview and review, just kind of looking it over and maybe making some comments or suggestions, but staff will be doing the lion's share of the work.
Well, you made a good example is accessory dwellings and the size of accessory dwellings. So let's talk about let's look at how many we've had and how many have approved and disapproved. And like Hope and I were talking,
you know, maybe it'll be a case of if you're on 5 acres, it can be 100% before it has to come to us.
But those are substantive changes that deserve some
suggestions or possibilities.
And discussion. Yeah. So we'll try to point those out and figure out how to identify those.
For example, parking is one thing that you have some thoughts and ideas on and whatever. And, you know, we'll look at, that's kind of what we kind of look at and what's stumbling blocks, what's whatever. So
do you anticipate having Planning Commission workshops so that we can, you know, just throw ideas out and talk about things without having to act on anything, but just let's figure out, you know, is this feasible or is this not feasible? Those kinds of discussions.
Yeah, that's a good and we're open to suggestions now as to how to do it. So if you have suggestions, let us know. And I would say, you know, start thinking about those things like that in the code that bug you, so that when we get to that point to have some discussion, let's start. Maybe we should
have my list.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea. That might be a good start, actually, is to just with the discussion. If you have some things that you think need to be addressed, we could put those on the list and start there. That would help. That might go back and help us formulate how to go through the sections of the code to tackle that. That's a good idea.
Any other comments from commissioner comments? Public comment. Any public comment at this time? Seeing none, for possible action, a motion for adjournment.
So moved. Second.